on a Monday.
Monday morning. What we're going to do is the bills listed for public hearing, we're going to do a tap-tap type of hearing is something we call just to keep these bills alive, since today's the Senate President's deadline for all of the House bills currently in our possession. So I'm going to open a public hearing in mass on House Bill 2057, 2059, 2060, 2063, 2064, 2086, 2095, 2099, 2101, 2111, 2113, 2114, 2150, 2206, 2207, 2221, 2275, 2276, 2284, 2314, 2316, 2318, 2422, 2425, 2449, 2594, 2682, 2727, 2736, 2761, 2770, 2866, 2873, 2885, 3107, 3317, 3351, 3361, 3366, 3370, 3371, and 3372. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on the aforementioned bills. So now that those are procedurally alive, I know it sounds kind of stupid, but there we go. All right, next up, the bills for Mr. Chamoff. Since he's here and he has another hearing, do we know which ones they are?
Yes.
Counsel, tell me what they are.
Mr. Chairman.
Pull a rabbit out of your hat.
I was going to say, Greg, help me out here, if you could. Which bills? I believe it's 2319, and is it 2322 as well?
Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council, there's at least House Bill 2319 and House Bill 2322. We were under the impression that House Bills 2314, 2316, and 2318 were also on the schedule, but those may be there only for purposes of public hearing and not work session.
All right, but well, we can go back to them if they're technical bills if you want, since you're here. Do you want to explain all three of them?
So there's a total of five.
There's a what?
There are a total of five bills
right
on your calendar today.
Well, let's go to the ones that the members, I'm sure, have their bill files for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Those are House Bill
2319. We'll do a public hearing on 2319.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council. Mr. Joseph is handing out a synopsis of each of the five bills. The two that we're discussing right now are on the second page of your materials, the first being House Bill 2319. In 1953, when the Legislative Assembly created the Office of the Legislative Council and instructed the office to publish the Oregon Revised Statutes, the Legislative Assembly included a number of commands, such as retaining the metal type or plates used to publish the Oregon Revised Statutes. Those are now useful as paperweights, but little else, because we do the publishing electronically. The changes in House Bill 2319, although substantive, simply reflect the way that the office has been conducting business for a number of years, not the way the office was conducting, or not the way the office conducted business in 1953.
All right. Any questions by the committee?
Yeah.
All right. Any questions? There are none. No questions. Where's my vice chair when I need her? Do a work session, 2319. Anybody want to facilitate this? Senator Ringo.
I move 2319 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo moves House Bill 2319 unamended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I like the two presiding officers have to consult with each other language. That sounds like a good thing. All right?
Mr. Chair, should this be on the consent agenda?
We can certainly make that. Senator Ringo, would you move a friendly amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move 2319 to the floor, would be passed recommendation, and we put it on the consent calendar.
All right, Senator Rago now moves House Bill 2319 unamended to the floor of the Senate and that it be included in the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Motion passes. Senator Walker, should there be any explanation necessary, I'll turn to you for complete and full explanation for the Senate floor.
Oh, all right.
Okay.
I can do that.
All right, we're cooking now. Let me see. 2322. Public hearing. Mr. Chamoff, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council. From time to time over the years, the Legislative Assembly has added domestic relations statutes, which is the editors of the Oregon Revised Statutes. We placed into Chapter 107 many of these statutes. Most people assume, and they probably should, link to other statutes that, for example, provide definitions, but in the days when we were adding those sections to the code, we weren't as rigorous in our endeavors as we are now, and what this bill does is pick up some of those floating sections and add them specifically into the parts of Chapter 107 to which they probably should have belonged, so that, among other things, the statutes will pick up the definitions that people have probably been using with them all along.
All right. Any questions of Mr. Chamoff regarding this fine piece of legislation? There are no questions. Work session, House Bill 2322. Senator Rinko.
Move 2322 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and it will be placed in the consent calendar.
Okay, Senator Rinko moves House Bill 2322 unamended by this committee to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, and that it be included in the consent calendar of the Senate. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? No opposition. Motion passes. Senator Starr, you would find a piece of technical legislation. Mr. Chamoff, I don't know if the committee, some committee members brought all of their bills, others did not. We could, let's try 2314 and see if we can explain it, and I'll pull my bill out if I've got it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council. The key part of House Bill 2314 is in line 11, which lists a long string of statutes that supposedly provide for the protection of a minor or another person. In fact, some of those don't. They're mistakes. They refer to penalty provisions and other things that probably shouldn't have been in that list in the first place. So what this bill does is replace some of the mistaken references with a generic description of a person for whom a trust has been established.
All right, great. Thank you. Council also tells me that we set these only for public hearings.
That's
so
correct.
I don't know who dropped the ball, probably me. In any event, let's do a little public hearing on the rest, and then we won't have to bring you back again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's go to public hearing on 2316.
Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council, 2316. A few years ago, the Legislative Assembly abolished the Board of Trustees of the Children's Trust Fund. That was the entity that used the money from the checkoff on the tax return for child abuse prevention. You abolished the board and created a new nonprofit corporation that took over that responsibility, subject to certain contingencies. The transfer has taken place, and House Bill 2316 revises the law to eliminate the contingencies.
All right. Any questions of Mr. Chamoff regarding 2316? There are none. We'll close the public hearing on 2316. Open a public hearing on 2318.
Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council. 2318 makes technical corrections to the statutes involving the state archivist. The highlight of this measure is the change in Section 2 to ORS 192-250. That's a statute in which the Legislative Assembly has instructed the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to report to the Legislative Assembly on various topics, but in making that direction to the department, didn't tell the department how often to report. So what this amendment does is tell the department to report to the Legislative Assembly at least once a biennium.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chamoff. Any questions of Mr. Chamoff? All right. We're going to bring back 2314 and 2316 on Wednesday for work session. 2318, the chair is going to hold on to for a short period of time, pending some potential amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, 8:30 tomorrow morning. Council tells me 8:30 tomorrow morning for work session on the two bills. So, Chamoff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's do that. And let's see, we're moving right along here. Committee on board here. Everybody happy?
Okay.
Have a good weekend.
Senator Fraioli is keeping his distance.
You sound terrible. Okay, let's do a public hearing on 752. Mr. Myers, Attorney General of the State of Oregon, is present here. We'll deem his time. Mr. Myers.
And Mr. Chairman, this has already been set for a public hearing once. I think we already heard it very briefly on a tap-tap basis. And what this is the Sexual Assault Victims Medical Response Fund. And there should be -2 amendments that you have. Briefly, the -2 amendments delete some language from line 10 that deletes the language emergency contraception. Line 15 also deletes that language. And in line 17, make sure that the availability of funds is from gifts, grants, and donations. Mr. Chairman, this bill had a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but I spoke with the Ways and Means officers, and Kevin Neely, who works for Mr. Myers, has been speaking with them also, and they assure me that with that language, it makes it clear that this is only to be funded by non-general funds money and does not need to go into Ways and Means if the -2 amendments are adopted. So we could rescind that if you'd like.
All righty. Let me do a little work session, see if I can get the committee to cooperate with me. Charles, yeah, I probably have some testimony. You want to talk to us? Go ahead.
Briefly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I'm joined by Phyllis Barkhurst, who is the coordinator of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. The task force was formed in 1999 to help foster a coordinated community response to sexual assault. And under the task force auspices, we have been working to foster the creation of sexual assault response teams in every county and to provide multidisciplinary training under a sexual assault training institute, which the task force is conducting. We have trained about 150 law enforcement professionals to date, and this morning in Eugene, which is apropos given this bill, we are opening a 5-day training of sexual assault nurse examiners, which is the first training of its kind in Oregon's history. In the course of its work, the task force has identified first medical response to sexual assault victims as one of the critical shortcomings of our current system, judged in terms of a coordinated community response or lack of it. Law enforcement agencies, due to an unfunded mandate from the 1987 legislature, are responsible for the authorization and payment of the forensic medical examination of sexual assault victims in Oregon, but not the payment of the merely medical or health exam of the rape victim. There's confusion in most jurisdictions and a wide range of inconsistencies across the state as to what constitutes the forensic exam and what constitutes the medical health exam. Hospitals across the state are billing local police jurisdictions and or insurance companies anywhere from $250 to $1,500 per patient for the performance of the same examination and evidence collection process. And some hospitals to avoid the law enforcement payment situation entirely are billing the victim's health insurance for the so-called rape kit medical exam, which is in direct conflict with the current law that mandates that law enforcement pay such costs. Insurance companies are being billed for charges that are specific to the forensic evidence collection in addition to the medical care costs. Hospitals across the state are inconsistent in how they distinguish and bill for these costs. And to sum up, victims and advocates across the state report the most common way to describe the hospital response and this dual role of healthcare forensic evidence collection as inconsistent and confusing. So the task force has generated Senate Bill 752 after a good deal of work and investigation. And to conclude our brief testimony, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask if Phyllis would briefly explain to the committee how this new mechanism would work.
Sure.
Go ahead, Phyllis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members. The task force put together...
Do me a favor. Officially identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And speak up, because I'm getting older and hard of hearing.
My name is Phyllis Barkhurst, and I'm a coordinator of the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. And as the Attorney General said, seeing that this was a large problem, we put together a work group that worked for over a year, multidisciplinary effort to figure out a strategy that would meet the needs as identified. Senior Deputy DA Helen Smith from Multnomah County chaired the group, and after this period of time, we came up with a strategy of developing a statewide fund. First, because it would be the easiest for the victim. Second, it would be the easiest for the hospital. Third, it would ensure that all the problems that we had identified earlier would be met. And fourth, it would include repealing the statute that required law enforcement to pay for such exams that isn't working, as the Attorney General talked about. So it still includes working with law enforcement. So when somebody comes to the emergency room, law enforcement, of course, is involved for the forensic evidence portion. But it also includes provisions, so for victims who don't report the crime or still want or need medical attention, that they will receive it at the emergency room. This bill reflects a complete or comprehensive approach. So when somebody walks into a hospital, the system is ready and prepared to respond no matter what needs they identify. And it's an easy process. And we believe that... That it's comprehensive enough that it's not going to take the amount of time and resources from the hospital perspective or the victim's perspective to make it effective. As the Attorney General mentioned, the fund includes no general revenue dollars. The plan is for the fund to be comprised of monies from federal victim funds, which pay for some of these costs, the Department of Justice Criminal Injuries Assessment Account, and private contributions from insurance companies, pharmacy companies, and hospital foundations. We have met with some key insurance lobbyists and believe that there's interest in pursuing this plan from the insurance company perspective. And a key component to the plan, of course, is the agreement by participating hospitals not to bill insurance companies then for the examination. So we feel it's a win-win situation all the way around.
Phyllis, one of the problems I know we've had in our sexual assault detail is when you get a case involving a fraternity, that oftentimes the district, well, not often, the district attorney's office simply will not pay for the tests to determine paternity,
right,
because they assume that it's something related to DHR and et cetera, et cetera. But it oftentimes is critical evidence that we need to prosecute statutory rape cases. So that this fund, I'm assuming, would not pay for that kind of testing, or would it potentially?
It's not designed to pay for that kind of testing. No, Mr. Chair.
All right. That's one of the areas that I think we found a deficit, is that there are few clinics or few laboratories in the West, on the West Coast, that will do that kind of testing, and it seems to be relatively expensive to do. So as far as evidence for criminal prosecutions and statutory rape cases, it would be nice if we had an opportunity to identify a way of, you know, using a fund or an idea like this to help get that evidence. The DA's office doesn't like spending, you know, $1,000, $1,500 for that kind of testing, and rightfully so, since their budgets are stressed, but it does create problems for prosecution. So I'll just highlight that issue, and I'm looking to my committee. Any questions for Mr. Myers or Phil?
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Ms. Barkhurst for coming. She is from my community, and Eugene has been very active in these issues, and I appreciate her efforts on the task force.
All right. And actually doing these kind of cases, it would be nice to have some standards and I think some level of understanding in the medical community regarding, you know, how they do these exams, where the money comes from, because that does seem to be one of the larger issues that you face.
Mr. Chair, that's one of the projects for this year that we've just completed and have turned over the proposed protocols to the Oregon State Police Crime Lab for their review, and the nurses that are being trained this week in Eugene are being trained on that protocol, so that we do have that larger picture for this fund to fit into.
Right. That's good. All right. Anybody ready to do a work session or not? Click on the work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 752.
Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 752. Discussion? Objections? None. Motion passed.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move Senate Bill 752 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and the referral to the Ways and Means Committee be rescinded.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 752 as amended to be sent to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation and that a letter be sent to the Senate President to rescind the referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee, predicated upon his or their consent. Any discussion on the motion? Objection to the motion? No objection. Motion passes and the chair will carry the bill.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Ryerson, thank you very much.
Very
appreciate it. Phyllis, thank you so much. All right. Where are we?
Can you do
All right. Let's move to Senate Bill 90. And this is a work session, Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, over a month ago, we heard testimony on Senate Bill 90. This is a speed racing bill. You may recall that we heard testimony, I believe, from one of the sergeants in Portland who has dealt with this and talked to us about the difficulties that speed racing has posed up in Portland with some, unfortunately, some deaths occurring out of it. And so we heard that testimony quite a while ago and have been working on amendments on this bill. There are -2 amendments to Senate Bill 90, and there is also a fiscal. So I'm going to make sure we have all that for all the members before I keep going. So members, let me know when we find that.
All right. Hand in gross, but I don't seem to have it.
I got the
I found it.
Okay. Hand in gross. I got the -2. Think we're in business.
I have it all.
In business?
Yep. We're ready.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, this bill has been amended, and it will need to go to Ways and Means. I'd like to thank Mr. Landauer and Department of Transportation for providing a lot of information and also the Judicial Department for working on that information. We were kind of shocked to find out that there are a lot of tickets written for speed racing. And you'll see on the fiscal, the numbers, that there were 1,300 convictions for speed racing in 2001, and 665 of those were tried in state court. The reason I bring that up is the -2 amendments would make speed racing a Class A misdemeanor if the person is driving the vehicle. You may recall, as it's currently written, speed racing, a person can be convicted and it would be a violation for anyone who participates in any manner in any of the following. So that has included the, I don't know what you, for lack of a better word, the people watching, the audience, the people, I don't know, I've never seen speed, but, you know, the people who are watching and who are organizing it. In cooperation with Mr. Landauer, the -2 amendments made a couple changes. Speed racing would be unlawful not only on a highway, but also other premises open to the public. That would include, for example, if it were possible for them to do this on parking areas, anything like that. Language was added to make it clear that an organizer or person who aids in organizing a speed racing event is subject to this. But the important thing would be, Madam Vice Chair, the organizer would still be only a Class A violation. We're only raising it to Class A misdemeanor for those people who are driving. And I think the policy behind that was because, unfortunately, they're the ones that are causing the danger, and the drivers are the ones that have caused some deaths in Portland. So, and also, we originally were looking at making this broader to follow up and including organizers, but Senate Bill 189 will deal with those, and we have that on the agenda as well. So I think that the idea behind this is both public policy and practicality of trying to keep the fiscal as reasonable as possible.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I have a question for Council. The fiscal is on dash one amendment, which I haven't seen. The dash two or the one?
That's Madam Chair, Vice Chair, you're absolutely right, and I should have brought that up. We had them do a full fiscal on the dash ones, and then dash two did narrow the net a little bit, but unfortunately it's not going to narrow it enough to, it's still going to need to go to Ways and Means, because the belief is that most of those are written for drivers.
Okay.
So when Troy Costales from ODOT gave us the best numbers he could, it looked like most of that 1,300 convictions are for drivers currently, so it will still need to go to Ways and Means. Thank you for pointing it out.
Try as we may to get rid of the fiscal, we just couldn't do it. So.
Could I ask Council a question?
Go ahead, question.
Do you have any idea how many of the total of these convictions are they spread out all over the state, or are they pretty concentrated in the fair city of Portland?
Senator Burdick, I do have numbers. They're not concentrated
Senator
only.
Burdick?
I'm sorry. Is it a Monday morning or what?
It is, and my hearing's bad.
Senator Walker, excuse me. Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I do have some numbers, and I assume you'd kind of be interested in Lane County.
I would.
Lane County has only had a few of these, four citations in 2001. As I recall, and I'm going to get my numbers here, I've got them right here. The big counties are Multnomah and Clackamas and, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, let me make sure I've got these numbers right.
Take your time. We're ahead of schedule.
Okay.
What about Washington? We go ahead past the Washington County.
Are you still living in Washington County? As long as
you can drive that fast in Washington County just to save your life.
No, that's okay. Mr. Chairman, I've got such a breakdown, it's almost difficult. Troy Costales, a lot of these are dealt with by city courts. They're traffic violations, so they can be dealt with in municipalities. So, for example, Beaverton had 96 tickets in 2001. But if you're looking at it a county-by-county basis, I think Multnomah is still going to be the biggest. And Medford, Oregon, is that right? And Josephine County also has some bigger numbers. So it is throughout the state. Josephine County had 43 citations in 2001. Jackson County, looks like most of those were done in the cities. So I have a lot of numbers. They're hard to kind of break down, but it is a statewide issue.
Well, that's good to know. At least for the most part, Lane County behaves itself.
Behaves itself. And I will say, too...
it's never been my experience.
I was going to let that one slip by.
I was hoping you might.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Walker, in Multnomah County, there is a forfeiture place in place for a city ordinance, and also out in East County, I believe. Or it's just in the county. Not anymore. Impound, excuse me. Did I say forfeiture? I didn't mean to get the Constitution mixed up there.
Well,
impounded these vehicles, and there's a hope that that will bring down the numbers,
uh-huh.
but we had to go with the numbers we have currently.
Okay.
So that's the reason for the large, you know, number of citations and why everyone believed this had to go to Ways and Means.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that.
Sorry.
I just wanted to make sure this was a statewide problem and not just limited to certain counties. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Is the committee happy with this one? Notwithstanding the fact that it has to go to Ways and Means.
I wish them well.
We wish them well. Okay. In work session. Senator Burdick.
I move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 90.
Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 90. Discussion by the committee. Additional discussion? There's none. Any objection to the motion? No objection. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move that Senate Bill 90, as amended, be reported out with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Burdick moves that Senate Bill 90, as amended by this committee, be referred to that the Joint Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Yeah, Joint Ways and Means.
Yes. Any discussion on the motion? Any objections? No objection. Motion passes and the bill now moves to Ways and Means. All right. Senate Bill 189, work session. Council, are you ready for this topic?
I'm ready, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Senate Bill 189, let's get my papers. You should have a fiscal, you should have a hand engrossed bill, and you should have dash 1 amendments. And by the way, I want to thank Jane for doing all the work on hand engrossing these again. It's very helpful. Senate Bill 189, we heard this bill at the same date as 90, and amended this one so that it only applies to the organizers of speed racing on a highway. And we heard testimony that some of these are organized, and this would make that a C felony. By the way, the or aids in organizing was deleted, but the theory of aiding and abetting does not need that language. So if you can show if someone intentionally assisted or promoted organizing, you'd be able to sustain a prosecution, I believe, under that theory. So the irony here is, I think originally the thought was making this a felony would make this one go to Ways and Means, but actually it was the exact opposite, that because there's a few of those, if you look at the fiscal, and I talked with the fiscal people, they believe it will be minimal. So that's that was a weird turn of events on that one.
Yes, Senator Bree.
I still don't understand that, despite your articulate.
Well,
try again.
I will try again.
Zach, back up.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, the numbers are so low, and there won't be. It's not estimated that there will be any incarceration, so the overall impact will be indeterminate but minimal. Is what the Ways and Means people say.
So, Mr. Chairman, as I gather now, there's no law to go against organizers.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, the way that the statute did read, it read participates, and I'm going to grab 90. The current statute, which is the one we amended, is 811.125. It says the person drives a vehicle or participates in any manner in any of the following in which a vehicle is involved, and it would include any of those. I think technically participates in any manner would be included. It's difficult to prosecute. You'd have to have someone basically cooperate and explain that someone set this up with cell phones or some way was communicating with the drivers and letting everybody know, hey, there's a race down at, you know, whatever street. So My understanding is, from the research they did, they found that really officers have been just doing the drivers for the traffic violations. So putting together a fiscal was difficult, and that's why it's indeterminate and minimal. And so they did not believe that it needed to go to Ways and Means. Is that better?
That sounds good.
All right.
Ready for motion?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Work session here, I think we are. Senator Burdick.
I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 189.
Senator Burdick moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 189. Is there discussion? Any objections? No objections. Motion passes.
Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move Senate Bill 189 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 189 as amended before the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections to the motion? No objection. Motion passes. And I'd like to carry this.
Since your county has the bulk of them, Mr. Chair.
Since my sheriff asked.
Are you a stealth candidate for most bills carried?
I do not want to win that award. Trust me. Let me see. Now where are we? We're done.
My last one is.
Right. 342, we're going to hold over to. Brian had another. Hearing in another committee, we'll be coming back soon.
Should we switch into bills? Bills, bills.
Yes. One bill in your
right hand. Let me get that.
Everybody happy out there? Okay, good. Not much entertainment going on in the Judiciary Committee today, so.
Unless you want to hear my barking seal act.
Yeah, how did you get ill like that?
I rode on an airplane.
Where'd you go?
China.
Oh, good. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
All right. We're here, work session on Senate Bill 60. Four, and then we've also got 217. We had some discussion.
Do you want to hear them at both the same time? It's my understanding, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that Senate Bill 64 and 217 deal largely with the same issue. Warren Darris is here to testify on the new amendments. It's my understanding that most of the controversial items have been taken out of Senate Bill 64, so it's more of a technical bill. And that Senate Bill 217 now contains some of the more controversial items, those being some fee items as well as some timing issues with respect to my calendar here.
Okay, well, we heard this, a week or so ago, and we went through this litany of pulling out the offensive components of the
Ray.
All right. Okay, but Warren, I don't want to get into a really deep discussion on this if I can avoid it. Anybody out there that wants to oppose what we're doing, that wants to speak on the record? Key being, wants to speak on the record. 64 right now. Okay. No objections to that one? Okay. Okay, we're in work session on Senate Bill 64. We're looking at the dash 3 amendments, Mr. Joseph. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right.
You want a motion?
I do.
Mr. Chairman, I move the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 64.
All right. Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 64. Any discussion? And I'm assuming that there have been no changes from the discussion we had a week or so ago about making 64 mostly a technical bill dealing with DSL and their processes and such. All right. Any further discussion on the adoption of the motion? Any objection to the adoption of the motion? No objection. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Burdick.
I move Senate Bill 64 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick now moves Senate Bill 64 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there additional discussion? Okay.
Yeah, just a major headache. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank the parties for the education on this subject, and I've really enjoyed learning about it, and I appreciate that they've come to some agreement on 64. When I'm 64, I shall pass the bill.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion?
Even those of us who are non-lawyers, I think, should get CLE credit at the benefit of Mr. Darris.
All right. That's good. Mr. Darris, can you make sure we get little certificates or something? All right. No further discussion. Any objection to the motion? There's no objection. Motion passes. And Senator Walker, since you like that bill so much, we'll have you carry that.
The sheets and devisees and all those things.
All right. Now let's move on to section Senate Bill 217, and this is the one that has the more controversial provisions in it. Warren, you want to come up and explain what 217 looks like and what components are in here that...
Your Honor, today, Warren Darris. I'm an attorney in private practice in Oregon and also under a contract with the Department of Justice. I represent the Division of State Lands and Escheat Estates. Before the committee today are two separate, independent, gut and stuff amendments to Senate Bill 217. The first, 217-2, would change the law of intestacy in Oregon to eliminate the shares of descendants of the grandparents of a decedent who died at age 60 or older. The second amendment, 217-3, would limit fees payable to airship search firms for finding heirs to amounts approved by the probate court, as attorney fee and personal representative fees are currently approved by the probate court, or alternatively to a percentage of the share of the heir that the firm finds. In other words, they get a guaranteed base percentage. If they want to go for more, like the personal representative who gets a guaranteed base percentage fee, they'd have to go to the probate court to get approval of the court. In the situations where we are working in the probate court, I do have to point out that in administrative proceedings to determine heirship, which arise after the court proceedings sometimes when there's an escheat, the court would not be available, so they would in those cases be limited to the percentage fees. In considering the presentations I have made on these issues in the past this weekend, it occurred to me that there was really one gap in my presentation, and that is that this bill depends, understanding of this bill depends on a knowledge of intestacy law in Oregon, and I don't believe I ever clearly explained how that works and how it was changed in 1969 when the entire probate code was revised to generate a good deal of the problem with which we are dealing today. So I brought with me a three-minute lesson in escheat, if the committee will bear with me. It's in the packet of materials that hopefully has been provided to each member of the committee. In 1969, the following three changes were made to the law of intestate succession. First, the law eliminated the heirship status of relatives and descendants of ancestors of a decedent above the level of grandparent. In other words, great-grandparents and their children and grandchildren and so on, great-great-grandparents, all those were eliminated. Not really much of a change, because usually if you couldn't find descendants of grandparents, you couldn't find descendants of great-grandparents. Second, it provided the shares of missing heirs or devisees would escheat. Prior to 1969, Oregon statute provided that you could ignore someone that you couldn't find, and their share effectively would be divided among those that you could find. The most significant change was in 1969 the law introduced the right of representation as the mechanism for dividing estates among descendants of grandparents, among collateral heirs. The right of representation means when somebody dies, their children take their share. Okay. I have some charts in the materials that I've provided you that demonstrate exactly how this works, and I want to explain to you the keys on those charts. All of those charts focus on the kind of estates that are the problem before the committee. No spouse, no children, no grandchildren, no brothers, no sisters, no nieces, no nephews, no surviving parents. So we go up to the grandparents, who invariably are dead, and down to their descendants. In each of these charts, the box with the dark black frame is our decedent. In each of the charts, the dashed horizontal lines represent generations. The shaded boxes with the double outlines are the heirs, those who will inherit under intestacy law. The other boxes are other relatives who either have died or won't inherit, and they're all labeled by their relationships. In the first five examples here, which I'm going to go through very quickly, we have the same family situation. The decedent had a paternal aunt who had two children and three grandchildren, a maternal aunt who had one child and four grandchildren, and of course we also have the philandering maternal uncle who had four children by his three failed marriages. And by the way, if you don't think that really happens, my father had nine children by his three failed marriages. The first example is labeled the pre-1969 Oregon Probate Code. And in that situation, where we have, in a typical situation, the decedent outlived half of the relatives at his generation, but he has two cousins surviving. Under the old law, those cousins split the estate equally. They each got 50%. Now you flip to the next page, the current law, you can see there has been a dramatic change. We have shifted to the cousins once removed, taking the shares of deceased cousins by right of representation. The universal view of probate is that this is a fairer system and a much less arbitrary system, but it creates a significant complication. And that complication on this chart is that instead of having two heirs, we have 11. The next chart, just briefly, showed what happened under the old law if one of the two cousins died. The surviving cousin got 100% of the estate. A dramatic shift, entirely excluding the maternal side of the family in that situation. You can see why there was a sense, as you look at the next chart, that right of representation was more fair. The estate remains balanced between the two sides in proportion to their representation. But, again, we've added two more heirs. Now the two children of our deceased cousin become heirs, so we have 13. The last chart in this series shows what happens in a situation that we see regularly when the decedent is the last surviving member of his or her generation. There is, even with the right of representation now, a dramatic shift in the shares because the equal division level occurs at the closest level of kinship. That is no longer the level of cousins. It is now the level of cousins once removed. You can see that with the right of representation in the first four examples, we had a dramatic increase in the number of heirs that we have to find. You can see with the fifth chart that the shares of each year can change somewhat arbitrarily depending on deaths of distant relatives. In some cases here, going from a 6th to a 13th or from a 24th to a 13th. The next chart, the Gordon S. Weber estate, is an actual estate that we have dealt with over the last year. Mr. Weber died in Portland last year. The estate was brought to us because the conservator, who had spent some considerable period of time trying to identify heirs, had been unable to do so. I filed this probate in Multnomah County. After filing the probate, we hired an heirship search firm on an hourly basis, Brandenberger and Davis, and they identified the grandparents and some of the descendants of grandparents. With that assistance, I was able to identify fairly quickly the paternal cousins, Mr. Denton, the one surviving cousin, and the two children of his deceased sister. Cameron Sheehan, one of those two children, became the personal representative. Under our rules, we had to withdraw at that point. With the continued assistance of Brandenberger and Davis, and with some additional involvement by me, the maternal heirs were all identified and found. Unfortunately, during the course of administration, James Denton, the one surviving cousin, died last month before the estate could be distributed. But this estate is going to be distributed to these heirs. It cost about $10,000 to identify these heirs. I'm the one who made the initial contacts with them, and I can tell the committee this. Of all these heirs, James Denton was the only one that told me he knew the decedent. And he had not spoken to him for years and didn't know his wife had died 2 years earlier. Particularly the maternal heirs, who were related through their great-grandmother, did not have a clue as to what the relationship was and why they were inheriting from $50,000 to $100,000, other than that they were happy to get it. And that's typically the kind of situation we see. In my outline, I say that there is another chart attached. In fact, that is not attached because it is an ongoing matter in which I've decided I don't want to put the heirship chart that I've developed on the public record. It's attorney work product and privileged. But I can tell you what that estate involves. That involves a woman who died in Portland last year. She was an only child. She was born in 1922 when her parents were in their early 40s. Her parents had immigrated from England in 1919, the only members of their families who had immigrated. The mother had seven brothers and sisters. The father had seven brothers and sisters. We have 14 aunts and uncles that we have identified. Our decedent, by the way, had absolutely no contact, from the records we have found, with any of her relatives in England. But the descendants of those aunts and uncles, the youngest of whom was born in 1886, will be the heirs under current law in this estate. My estimate is that there will probably be between 50 and 100 heirs. We will spend a great deal of time, effort, and money identifying these people, telling them that they get a share of the estate, and trying to explain their relationships. I have no hope that we're going to find all of them. The -2 amendments would eliminate the need to do that with respect to decedents like this one, who are older than 60 years old, therefore very likely have lost contact with these descendants of their grandparents. And and who are capable, if they want to provide for the descendants of their grandparents, of making a will. It would simplify administration not only of intestate estates, those where there's no will, but of testate estates. In my 32 years of practice, I've done a number of wills for individuals who have no spouse, children, issue, nieces, nephews. My experience in planning for these people is that this, I have never had one who wanted to provide for cousins. But when we probate their estates, we are required by law to give notice to heirs, and that means to cousins. And in most of these cases, my experience has been the clients don't know their cousins. In that situation, I always try to get a family tree from them, so I'll be prepared to give that notice. Again, my experience is, as an attorney doing estate planning for clients, that my clients in this situation are not looking to provide to their cousins. They are much more likely to be looking to provide for charities or friends. My experience working for the Division of State Lands is that when these folks die without wills, or more frequently, I would point out, with wills that are defective, that's the usual problem we get in the larger estates. And those wills never provided for the cousins. The cousins we ultimately find are strangers. That is why, based on my experience, I think the Dash 2 amendments are an appropriate change of Oregon law to recognize what people want and the reality of family relationships in modern America. The effect of eliminating the rights of heirship of a small class of individuals will be that those shares will go, without the need to incur this expense to search for heirs, will go to the common school fund, which is, again, an appropriate place to put it. My experience is most of these people tend to leave a large part of their estates to charities. And it certainly shouldn't go into the general budget. Of course, the Constitution dedicates SG to the Common School Fund, but it certainly shouldn't go into the general budget because it's simply not a reliable source of funds. It varies greatly from year to year. $6 million estate in Washington County last year was certainly unusual, but I would expect we're talking about a few million dollars every year to the Common School Fund as a result of this proposed change.
All right, questions from the committee. Senator Walker, how are you feeling? Ready to pursue this?
No. I'm not. Mr. Chair, thank you for asking. Mr. Darris, I appreciate what you're trying to do, but I'm just sitting here thinking about the possibility of being a long-lost cousin of some wealthy relative and how much I would enjoy receiving those funds should they ever become available. And I know we have long-lost relatives who are wealthy in our family, but they're long-lost.
You're obviously not Irish, because you wouldn't have any hope of that ever.
Well, Ms. Chair, I'm half Irish, and the other half is French and German.
Mm.
And
in that case, you might have an
option. That's where the money comes from. So I just have a concern about that. And I know you took it out of 64 because it was controversial for a reason. So I just have concerns.
All right. Any other committee questions, concerns? Senator Starr?
Well, I agree with Senator Walker. My family's done extensive genealogical research. We've traced 13 generations pretty thoroughly. And I do also have difficulty with this amendment. Mr. Chair.
All right, good. Senator Byrd.
I like the amendment, Mr. Chairman. I think Mr. Darris has made a good case that the intent of overall, and it's hard to generalize, but the intent of people is much more in line with wanting to put it into some public purpose, and I don't think it gets any better than schools. And I think it would be a positive change. I think just because you happen to have some blood relation to somebody, it's just kind of like winning the lottery. I don't see you're entitled to windfall. And I have a very large extended family, most of whom I don't know. So they have, since I got elected, I'm hearing from most of them. Which, to my great delight, I might say. But, so I'm getting to know them. But so far, I'm counting rich ones. But I think it's a positive change, and I would have no problem with the dash 2 on this. I have some concerns about the dash 3 on this.
Senator Ringo, where are you at on this topic?
Well, some of my cousins I know and some I don't know. But I think I would rather see that funds and possessions are passed along to heirs or people of the family, even if they're somewhat distant, than going to the state.
Of course, the underlying assumption, if I'm correct, is that there's some relationship that might exist between the decedent and the heir. The current law doesn't recognize that there was any relationship at all. If I'm following this correctly, I mean, even if you pass the legislation, you can write a will by and large any direction that you want, send your estate there. But now, again, you have people who are receiving proceeds of an estate who have had no relationship whatsoever, and in many cases didn't even know they had a relative that had the resources. So, I mean, that's kind of the central issue here. And then the issue I think Senator Burdick raises is, should that money just simply flow to individuals who have no relationship and no...
Mr. Kevin, you're saying like a personal relationship.
Right. I mean, in some cases have no knowledge that they even have a relative that... that had resources, as opposed to the state's interest, if there is one, and I think that maybe is one of the questions for the committee, is there a state's interest in those resources going to the common school fund as opposed to descendants that have zero relationship and perhaps zero understanding that they had a relative that had the money? So it's a big question. We haven't answered it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate those comments, because the common school fund is a good charity, if you want to call it a charity, which actually it is. But my concern is that over time, families have broken down, and I think Mr. Darris would agree with this, that in the early part of the century, we were very inclusive of our families and knew all of our extended family members. But as we have moved along through the years, I think people are less inclusive, and they just stay within their own family unit. And, I mean, I don't have family reunions. They used to do them all the time. Some people still do, I suppose. But, I mean, I shouldn't be penalized just because we don't have family reunions and I don't know my relatives. That's kind of where I'm feeling about this.
We do have a new estate that goes back to Germany. I'll talk to you about later.
Okay.
All right.
I think, as the chairman mentioned, you can do anything with your will except exclude your spouse. Spouse is entitled to 25%.
You're kidding.
minimum.
I'm sure she's here. All right. Matt, do you want to say anything here? I know you guys have got concerns, I think, about fee structure issues and so on and so forth. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing Brandenburger and Davis and Ayers, a locating company. While we were able to come to a compromise in Senate Bill 64 on those provisions, while they weren't all technical in nature, some of them were substantive, we were able to come to a compromise. These two provisions that were pulled out because we couldn't reach compromise, and we are adamantly opposed to the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments. The Dash 3 dealing with contingency fees, these are serious limitations of the fees. We feel that, you know, it is a competitive business. People aren't, there's nothing that stops people from searching for their own company after they receive a letter from one of these companies. And I just want people to realize that these locating companies do a lot more than just finding people. They approve relationships. They certify forms with the court. They make an accurate family chart. They also retain counsel to protect the heirs. And all these fees are paid up front by the locating heir company. And the locating air company doesn't receive any funds unless the air receives funds. An average case for these guys takes 18 to 24 months usually. And the contingency fee works well for them simply because, you know, they don't get paid on a lot of, on some of their cases they don't get any, they don't receive any funds. So a contingency fee is the way that it works best for them. On the Dash 2 amendments, where we're limiting the heirs of a of an estate without a will, I think people don't write wills for a lot of various reasons, whether that's because of the conflict it causes in their family, whether they're superstitious that when they write a will, something bad may happen. And I know Warren has stated that most wills aren't written to cousins, but some probably are. And you know, I don't know, I would guess that there's quite a few less that are actually written to the division of state lands. I think people would rather see their money given to family members rather than going to the state of Oregon. I know that people do write, do like to give their money to charities, but in those cases, they are written in a will as to which charities would like to be given to. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Now, which firm do you represent?
Brandon Berger and Davis.
Brandon?
Berger and Davis. Brandon Berger is one word.
Thank you. And where are they located?
They're located out of California.
All right. Because I went on the web, and there are tons of these search firms around the country. It almost seems like a consumer issue to me that some of these firms, I mean, you may represent one that's above board and does everything right, but it looked to me like there were some firms on the web that, you know, didn't seem to me like I would want to trust them from afar. It didn't seem too different than some of those Nigerian send me money things that you get from time to time. Okay, well, I think I don't know if there's anybody else who wants to testify on this particular issue. I want to kind of mull it over a little bit more before I try to...
Can I speak to the Dash 3 a bit?
Yes, sir, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my concerns about the fees, which I've mentioned in my outline with the committee, are this. First of all, state law creates the system of probate that we have. That's where these fees are incurred. And state law already recognized that when you have somebody who dies and their resources are simply loose and unattended, we have to have not only a structure to manage those assets, but one in which fees charged are regulated. State law says my fees have to be approved by the court as an attorney for a personal representative. State law sets the fee of the personal representative. The bill allows a very reasonable level of fees for these kinds of cases. My concern is that the standard one-third fee charged in domestic heirship searching, or the 50% fee charged now in searches in Europe, is grossly excessive in the simple case. And let me give you an example. The Brook estate came to me, representing after it was turned over to the Division of State Lands, after the conservator had billed the estate for hours trying to find heirs. And within 40 minutes of the file hitting my desk, I had identified every heir and talked to the decedent's nephew in California. It was a $500,000 estate. We billed the estate $114 for my time. If I were representing an heirship search firm, the bill would have been $160,000, $170,000, a third of the estate. In the Weber estate, the chart for which I gave you, in which we hired Brandon Berger and Davis at a reasonable hourly rate. They're a good firm, a firm that I respect. Their fee was about $6,000 between what we paid them and what the successor personal representative paid them. In addition, I would point out I had fees of about $4,000 for my time searching, identifying the heirs and contacting them. And this bill cuts off that part of my fees, and I'm still supporting this bill. But if the same work had been done by an independent airship search firm who had found these people and gotten them under contract for a third, the fee would have been over $300,000. This system encourages fraud. For heirs in Europe, we simply have no way of practically verifying the information we get. That $6 million estate I mentioned from Washington County, half of it went to heirs in Czechoslovakia. Okay? Nobody was in a position to verify, and in fact, all the transactions for distribution of that estate went through the heirship search firm that claimed to have found the heirs. I have at least one Division of State Lands case file where we had an absolutely fraudulent chain of heirship that we've had to deal with that was unfortunately very expensive. This was before I began representing the division. One-third fees in large estates create a lot of incentive for fraud, and it is very easy to do because in the hundreds of millions of people in the United States, there are an awful lot of them with the same name. And you just cross-link to somebody else with the same name, identify that family as the heirs because you can't find the actual one, and you've got a complete family tree, or at least it looks like it, on paper.
So, Ms. Darris, if I'm reading the fee schedule in the -3 amendment, on the $1.1 million estate, the firm would get at least $56,500 on a $1.1 million.
If there were a single heir.
If there were a single
heir. The fee is on a per-heir basis.
Per-heir basis.
The more complicated the estate... And keep in mind, the court can approve any reasonable fee.
Right.
But the more complicated the estate, the more heirs there are, with the fee structured on a sliding scale percentage basis per heir represented, the more heirs they find, the more they get. And I think that's appropriate. This is difficult work.
So because it's on a per heir basis, if there were more heirs, the search firm would actually get more than $56,000.
Yes. Now, that one in England where I expect we're going to have 50 to 100 heirs.
But if you were an attorney, how much would you charge?
I only charge on an hourly rate for the work I do for the Division of State
right.
Lands.
Now, can an attorney practicing in Oregon have a contract similar to what the search firms currently provide, 33% or whatever percent?
I think you'd be laughed out of court if you tried to claim a third of as a contingent fee.
But the court would have to approve the attorney's fee.
The probate court has to approve attorney fees paid from the estate in probate.
All right. So an attorney licensed to practice, more likely than not, would not receive anything near what these air search firms.
This is the attorney representing the personal representative.
Right.
If you have an attorney representing heirs, there's no regulation of those fees.
I see. All right.
Although this bill would impact that if the attorney were part of the function of finding the heirs.
Sounds like I'm in the wrong business.
Sometimes, I'll tell you, I think I am when I look at some of these estates that I've been involved in.
Senator Ringo.
I'd like to just explore a little bit further why you think the current fee structure encourages fraud. Do you think that the search firms will say, okay, we get X percent of this, the third percent, if we can find some people out there, so we'll just go make up some people out there and...
Let me tell you about the case that we had in which the funds had already been dispersed before I began working for the Division of State Lands. The decedent was an American Indian, Lisa Farron. The decedent's probate estate in Oregon was about $100,000. The decedent was also receiving benefits under the Indian Trust arrangements administered by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The trust administered by the Bureau of Indian Affairs was considerably larger than the estate. It was, I don't know, $500,000 to $1 million. BIA also had good records of family. The airship tree that was presented to the Division of State Lands was based upon the decedent's ancestor. I can't remember whether it was her father or grandfather, Billy Bob. And there was a nice chain going up to father or grandfather Billy Bob and going down to the seven or eight individuals who were claimed to be relatives of the decedent. What staff didn't know was that Indian agents used to commonly name Indians with two first names, and Billy Bob was a very common name. And the Billy Bob that they found was a totally unrelated individual. And I'm certain that they knew that because they made no effort at all to go after the much larger trust fund that was available at the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I want to emphasize this was not Brandenburger and Davis that we were dealing with in that case.
But I guess if people are committing fraud out there, let's take care of that.
Yeah, but it's all done out of state. All this work is done out of state. There are no in-state airship search firms doing this, and that makes it very difficult to deal with it in Oregon. I did refer that one to the criminal division for prosecution. Never heard anything further about it. I think the decision was just to give up on it. In that, the funds had already been dispersed when the file was referred to me on a collateral matter, and I looked at it and said, wait a minute, there's a problem here in this chart. But, you know, there was, a slight difference in the age of the two Billy Bobs that I noticed.
And it's your thinking that that fraud would not have occurred if there had been a smaller fee?
My thinking is that the level of fees encourages fraud, and I particularly think of the cases going to Europe where, again, the fee level is 50%, not a third, and it is much, much more difficult for us to verify records, particularly when they arrive in a foreign language where we don't have anybody that speaks it at the division. I mean, we've got estates of people with relatives in Vietnam right now, with relatives in Germany. I told you about the $6 million estate, half of which the relatives were in Czechoslovakia. It is, you know, virtually impossible for us to verify the records from every country. And let me just frankly state my underlying perception on these cases. I do believe that heirship should match personal relationships to some degree. If these folks have a relationship, they don't have to be found. At some point, they're going to get a Christmas card or a Hanukkah card back in the mail as undeliverable. They're going to find out the person died. It's not that they're not going to get their shares. What we create in many estates is a race between the personal representative with a statutory duty under Oregon law to identify heirs and heirship search firms trying to collect a substantial fee. And in a lot of respects, and I know that's not what's before you now, I kind of like the structure that I discovered just a few weeks ago that is commonly used in state statutes regulating search fees on unclaimed property, of have a window, a time period during which no fee can be charged, so that these easy-to-find people or self-finding people can come forward. I realize that is not what's before the committee now, but I see some merit in that. And I would point out that the rates, many states regulate the rates for this same function on unclaimed property. The rate in California is 10%, in Washington it's 5%. And usually unclaimed property is much smaller amounts. We are in larger estates offering what I view as a very generous amount to do the job. At the same time, I don't dispute that in some estates it's a lot of work. And in some estates, it's going to be fully justified to go to the court and ask for a reasonable fee based on the work that was actually done. And I intentionally left that option available.
All right. Mr. Darris, thank you very much. I think we pretty much exhausted our tolerance, I guess, for actually legislating. Anyway, I think we're going to hold on to this for just a little bit. And I do agree with you. I think that fee structure seems to be somewhat outrageous in my view, but that's just me. All right, I'm going to close the work session on 217. We have a work session on, well, let's do 743 as a bill limiting liability coverage for certain groups. Mr. Joseph, do you want to chat about that just briefly? The bill has to go to Ways and Means, I think. So.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 743 is a part of is a bill that essentially would limit tort liability for or extend tort liability coverage through the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to private community care providers that provide services. Essentially, there is one amendment that would limit it to private nonprofit community care providers. And that would hopefully limit the fiscal, but the fiscal information that we have in this bill right now is $2.3 million in the next biennium.
Right.
And so the concern, obviously, is that even with the limitation of making it private nonprofits, it would still be quite a large fiscal impact.
Right, and actually we don't have a revised fiscal, and the amendments were actually crafted to make more narrow the group homes and various private facilities that might be covered by this. Committee may remember the idea here was to bring in some marginal groups of individuals who are currently paying their own liability insurance, but they're also, in essence, agents of the state providing services to mental health patients and other individuals with chronic diseases or illnesses. So I guess my hope would be that we adopt the amendment, send it to Ways and Means, and let Ways and Means consider all of this in the totality of what they have to do. If that's okay with the committee. Senator Burdick? Senator Burdick now moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 743. Is there any discussion? Any questions? There you go. So ordered. Senator Burdick.
Chairman, I move Senate Bill 743 to the Ways and Means Committee.
Right. Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 743 as amended to the Joint Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? There's no objection. The motion passes. So there we go. Now we have one other bill, I believe, Senate Bill 342. And whose bill is this?
Mr. Craig's. Mr. Chairman, thank you, members of the committee. Senate Bill 342, I believe we just had a tap-tap type public hearing on this. This is a bill that amends ORS 475992, which is the possession, deals with, well, actually, that section deals with the delivery, manufacture, and possession of controlled substance. This bill only deals with the possession of controlled substance, which would be subsection 4. If you have the bill, it would be on page 2, line 18 is where I'm asking you to focus. This would make it a violation for a person to possess a controlled substance by consumption, basically. If a person is under 21 years of age, has intentionally consumed a controlled substance and is under the influence of the controlled substance. And then outlines that consume includes inhaling marijuana smoke.
All right.
That the person would be liable for Class A violation. Mr. Chair, the rest of the bill basically makes technical amendments to make that coincide with juvenile law and the various diversion plans that are set up for people who are convicted of that kind of violation.
All right. We have somebody signed up on this thing or not? Is it Lashman?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian DeLashman representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I think you actually did take some very limited testimony on this first go-round. I don't think it was quite a tap-tap, but this bill comes to you at the request of the Oregon Council of Police Associations, actually from their school resource officers. And the issue here is that the students are much more savvy about what they can get away with in the statute, and they know that if they come to school and they have consumed alcohol, that in fact they can get cited as a violation for consuming alcohol, minor in possession by consumption of alcohol. So they don't come drunk anymore, they come stoned. And this, what happens is then the school says, okay, well, you're out of here for a day or two or three, and the students laugh about it, and they come back 2 or 3 days later, and they're stoned again. And so the school resource officers and schools have no ability then to either get these people into a diversion, influence their behavior, and or alter their behavior at all. So again, this bill is very straightforward. It puts minor possession by consumption, including marijuana, as a violation. It's not a misdemeanor or a felony. It's the same as less than an ounce of marijuana. It gives the schools the ability and the school resource officers the ability to get these kids through the court system or into a diversion program and hopefully influence their behavior. And with that, I'll end.
All right. Questions for Mr. DeLange?
Questions for
Senator Farioli, then Senator Ringo, then Senator whomever else.
Page 2, Section 5, Line 23, Sub B. I'm just sure there's more ways to ingest marijuana than just smoking. So I'm just assuming that that the definition of consume couldn't, under the statute, include the ordinary meaning of consume, which is to ingest by eating. So I just think this is going to possibly make a run on the Betty Crocker section of the grocery store. So I guess if you're trying to consume in the ordinary meaning, would be to eat.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I guess I would read it slightly different. It doesn't say that it's solely by consumption, by inhaling marijuana smoke. It just says that it includes. So I guess I would read under line 21, sub large B, that the Betty Crocker situation could be handled in, under that particular situation.
Okay. Are you satisfied with that?
Mr. Chairman, it may be that my question is answered. You know, consume has the ordinary meaning plus inhalation that I'm satisfied.
All right. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. How is the school to know? I mean, you're just based on behavior, based on somebody else's testimony that they witnessed somebody else consuming marijuana. What sort of proof would exist?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, it's my understanding from talking to the school resource officers or all the police officers that, that I deal with that obviously if somebody's drunk, they can have them blow and there's a test for that. It's my understanding.
I'm sorry, say that again.
If somebody is drunk,
that's
if
right,
they have them blow and obviously you can...
Yeah, that's my point.
You can test for that. It's my understanding that you can also test for the consumption of marijuana, that there is a test for that, but you're starting to get outside of my area of expertise.
We happen to have a prosecutor formerly, and this you can share.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, and Kelly, you can explain it, this too, but there are trained drug recognition experts, which has been upheld as a scientific way to do that. Like it's like an alcohol field sobriety test. They check for nystagmus in your eyes. They check for pulse rate. They check on how your eyes can converge. But I don't know of a chemical test. Excuse me, because marijuana stays in your system for some time. You could check for the metabolite THC, but I don't think that's going to tell you if you're under the influence at that time. And Kelly, if you have, you know.
And this is a violation, so it doesn't have to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
It would be preponderance, Mr. Chairman.
Preponderance of evidence. So.
But I guess I would like to explore that. I mean, somebody shows up and they're acting kind of wacky. You know, teacher's going to say, this guy's stoned. And is that going to be sufficient? I'm just wondering how this is going to work in a practical.
My assumption is it wouldn't be sufficient because I think a police officer, and I'm assuming you have school resource officers, would have to articulate something more than a fellow was acting goofy. I would assume they'd have to have some comments by an individual indicating that they did or may have been smoking and something that it would have supported that. And they may smell like marijuana smoke and this kind of thing. So I think it would be under the totality of the circumstances, a citation would be issued, and then it's subject to whatever the courts might. It's my deem appropriate.
As is always the case, the chairman, the police officer, did a good job of explaining the circumstances.
You generally need more than just, I think so. Kelly, you want to step up here? And my assumption is you're in opposition to this.
Yes.
Yes,
sir.
That's okay. I just don't want my head to swell. So.
Chairman, as members of the committee, Kelly Skye, legislative representative with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we do oppose Senate Bill 342. We're generally opposed to the idea of creating a double standard for minors and adults, particularly in the area of controlled substance law, because while it's logical to bring smoking pot or using other controlled substances in line with minor possession by consumption, that seems like a logical step. However, minor possession by consumption of alcohol is on a record is a significantly different consequence than possession of a controlled substance. Possession of a controlled substance carries a significant stigma with it. Having that on an individual's record could have implications later in applying for schools or looking for housing when housing renters look at someone's record. They look for controlled substance convictions. We're also concerned about the idea of shifting school disciplinary problems into the courts. Basically, this is a school disciplinary problem, and what we're doing is we're on the road to criminalizing it and putting it in an arena that's not prepared to deal with
this minors. Doesn't make a crime out of it, though.
Right. It's a violation, but it's going to be handled with a fine in the state courts along with other offenses rather than through a school disciplinary process, which would be the more appropriate place.
But this wouldn't preclude an administrative process or some other action by the school as opposed to citation. I guess the way I envision this would be the school resource officers, there's a lot of interplay between the counselors, the principal, and those officers working in the school district. So it's very different than your standard traffic cop who would cite their own grandmother for jaywalking. Or a motorcycle policeman, God forbid you should be stopped by one of those fellows. So there's a lot more interaction and interplay between the participants in the circumstance than in general. So I guess that my assumption is that there would be alternatives, and those alternatives more likely than not would be utilized before they would actually issue a citation. It's based on my interaction with some of the school districts and trying to discuss criminal behavior involving their students. Oftentimes they do want to try to deal with it administratively.
And I agree that that's probably the true in many places, but we can't guarantee that those kind of diversion programs or alternative treatments will be available in every jurisdiction. And
right.
So,
but the little bugger's got to have some personal responsibility, don't you think?
That's true, but as this committee is well aware, minors tend to make mistakes.
I never did.
What? You never did? So we're concerned about further encumbering youth's records for mistakes that they made. And then as to Senator Ringo's question about the proof, it is true that there are drug recognition experts, and it's a very specific training that police officers can undergo. And to my knowledge, school officers are not trained as drug recognition officers. So that would present a problem, and I doubt very much that it would be a good use of the resource of a drug recognition officer to bring them into the schools to do the specific tests.
Mr. Chairman,
Yes, go ahead.
Except I guess I don't see that happening either. But on the other hand, somebody shows up stoned. The teacher says, "What's going on?" And the kid says, "Well, I'm stoned." You know, maybe that's all you need, and maybe there should be a legal mechanism to handle that.
Response then, Senator Farrell.
Well, Senator Ringo, I would disagree. The biggest concern that we have is the placing of a possession of a controlled substance violation on someone's record and the implications that that would have for a youth. Other than that, in terms of getting them into diversions and other types of programs, that's all well and good. But it does have a significant impact. And just to answer one other thing that you brought up, and that is in urine tests, the metabolite for marijuana does stay in the system for up to 30 days. So that's not an accurate way of measuring any influence.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Farrell, Council, wait, you wanted to clarify something, and then I'll go to Senator Farrell.
I'm sorry, sir. I wanted to clarify something, that this applies to juveniles under the age of 18 and up to 21. But I want to make it clear that in my experience in juvenile, something that's a violation would be dealt with informally through a formal, it's called a formal accountability agreement, or informally, meaning the counselor would work with that young person, and that would happen typically. The DA wouldn't be involved or anything.
All
so
right.
That's another option of how that could happen.
Senator Farrell, then Senator Walker, who's now eager to talk.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Brins brings up an issue that I was going to touch on. Our justice system is already bifurcated. We do a lot of stuff differently for youth than we do for adults. So I'm not persuaded by the argument that we ought to have of the same system for adults as we do for juveniles relative to controlled substance. So, you know, I think there is a lot of discretion. There's also, at the other end of the process, the opportunity for a youth to have a record expunged, even including these kind of cases. Mr. Chairman, the other thing is most schools in Oregon have a zero tolerance policy. So, I mean, obviously, avoidance is the best policy. You don't go stoned to school because you might get caught and you might get cited under this statute if you pass this bill. So I guess, Mr. Chairman, that because we already have a judicial system that treats juveniles differently, that juveniles apprehended, prosecuted, and cited, and they wouldn't just get a citation on this thing in a diversion agreement, would always have the ability to have that record sealed and expunged if they petition the courts and basically show some responsibility, go through the diversion successfully, and avoid the substance, and they can have their record expunged. So, Mr. Chairman, I think this probably just empowers the local community service officers and school police officers to do their job.
Senator Walker?
Oh, boy. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Farrioli, I respectfully disagree with you because this bill applies to people up to the age of 21. You cannot expunge your record after the age of 18. Your juvenile record is only up to the age of 18. I have seen what this bill does, what a violation has done to students who want to go to college. They're denied financial aid for simply smoking a joint. It's absolutely ridiculous that the federal government has taken that position, and I've seen young people have to stay out of school until a period of time lapses that they can then apply for financial aid. It can go beyond smoking a joint, of course, but I can't see teachers and school administrators standing there with pee strips or some other mechanism to identify whether these children are under the influence of a drug. And certainly if they're under the influence of a drug, Mr. Glashman, they can call their parents and have a discussion about that. But I believe, I strongly agree with Ms. Skye that you're setting up two different systems here, and it's just not appropriate, particularly since you're extending it to up to the age of 21.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, or Senator Walker, actually the choice of the 21 is a result of the fact that you have students that are older than 18 in high schools. So we had a pretty extensive discussion about how do you craft this in such a way that you catch the kids that are actually in school with the ages. But you really focus on the students. So Legislative Council actually suggested the parallel language to the minor in possession. I would point out to you that we already have the split handling of minors in possession versus adults who drink. This is just another example of an ability to try and influence some behavior very early on. The difference between 18 and 21, as I explained, was directly related to how do you write the statute without creating a whole new section. And so they decided to use the minor possession in the 21-year-old area, but actually get to the problem, which is the school children, too. So,
you know, I want to mention something, too. On Friday, I had breakfast with the three superintendents of Reynolds, Gresham, Barlow, and Centennial High School, and Mr. Ed Schmidt, who's the superintendent of the Multnomah County ESD. This issue actually came up in our discussion about issues that the school districts are unfortunately having to face, trying to deal with the number of students that are coming to school that are literally stoned. And that was their own assessment of behavioral issues and problems that they're facing. Now, they did also say that the unfortunate side of this is that many times the parents are not necessarily the most well-mannered or well-educated or, you know, well-constructed folks. And clearly these kids are coming from home environments that are not very good. But it is a problem in public schools, and I think it's an issue that probably needs to be dealt with. So,
Mr. Chair, the example that I'm given in many cases is where when you and I are going to school, some of the students would escape a block or two away and smoke a cigarette off campus. Yeah. The students now smoke marijuana a block or two away, and they don't actually have it in their possession when they come back. They either have ditched it someplace, hidden it someplace, or one non-student may be meeting them, but the students then immediately come back to school during the middle of the day stoned. That's the example that I'm given in many cases.
Right. All right, this is a work session. There are no amendments to the bill. So there we are.
Mr. Chair, I'm a no, so I'm not moving this bill.
Senator Walker's a no, and she adamantly is not moving the bill.
Chair, I'll move this bill.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 342 unamended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator Walker?
I just put my comments on the record, and I think we're going overboard here, and I understand there might be a problem in our schools, but it's been not a problem of recent days. I remember a place in Reedsport called the Weed Hole. It was where people went to smoke cigarettes and other things, and that was back in the 70s. So this is not a new problem, and I just think there's better ways of dealing with it.
Senator Ringo.
I admit to being conflicted on this. I think Senator Walker did make an interesting point about how this impacts student loans. And I come back to the question I ask on a lot of these, and that is there truly a deterrent effect? Are we just going to hammer people because they get something bad, or are we sending a signal that will deter behavior and somehow impact what people do? He didn't hear anything about that. Just a comment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I think the way this is going to be used, given the tight resources that we have in our justice system and in our schools, I think the way this is going to be used is really egregious situations. And I'm pretty confident that it's not going to be used. That most of the people will indeed be under 18 and have the protections that someone under 18 has.
All right. Any additional discussion?
Mr. Chair, in response to that, I would caution Senator Burdick that when she gets a college student at the age of 19 or 20 who loses their financial aid because they've been caught under this statute, to think about how that would
impact. I'm just not aware of
it.
That. I've known a lot of people who have done this, and I've not heard of people actually losing financial aid.
Actually, we're hiring police officers who've done this before, so there you go. Times are changing. All right, any further discussion? Any opposition other than Senator Walker? There's no other known opposition. Senator Walker dissents. Motion passes. Senator Burdick, if you would carry that. And I think that's all of the business before the committee, correct?
Yes.
Council?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're adjourned. We did the temporary. Well, it's feeling better.
Oh.